January 20th, 1983, Long Beach, California. Charles Armin, interviewed by Kay Briegel. Could you talk about your own background a little bit?
Oh, that's okay. This is my sister, Frances.
Hi, how are you?
Your name again?
I'm Kay Briegel.
Kay Briegel, yeah, okay.
I'll get out of your way. If you don't need the car, I'm going to run up and see Helen now.
No, go ahead.
Okay.
Maybe if you ask some questions or something, because
yeah,
I don't know if you...
Can you talk about where you were born? And
well, I was born in the state of Washington, a little town called Zilla.
Oh, really?
Yeah. My folks only lived there for about a year and a half after I was born and moved to South Dakota.
What did they do in Zilla?
Well, my father owned an apple orchard, a fruit ranch. It was just beginning. And he was working in a warehouse during the period of time that he was working trying to get the ranch to be a productive fruit ranch. And about the time that it was beginning, the trees were getting large enough that they would do something, why he sold it and moved back to South Dakota to go into the lumber business with his brother. And we lived there in this little town of Iroquois, South Dakota, until I was a junior in high school.
So that's where you went to school?
So I went to school in South Dakota, yeah. In this little town of about 500 people, mainly an agricultural, of course, society. Few small businesses in the small town, but no big business of any kind. A couple of railroads went through town. The economy was dependent totally upon the success of the farmer, which in that particular portion of the state and in that part of that period of time was very precarious. It was not really, they had their ups and downs. I went all the way through school, through the junior year in high school there, and then because of the serious depression in that part of the country, and I had an older brother and sister who wanted to go to school. Folks came out my senior year in high school, my mother rather, and the family came out to California where I had an aunt, my mother's sister. We lived out here during the winter while I finished my senior year in high school at Santa Monica.
Oh.
And my brother and my sister went to junior college while we were there. California, that was one of the advantages of California, you know, they had the junior colleges and it didn't cost much if you were living in the state. Most of the time as a kid, I was not associated in really any way with trade union movement. Didn't know much about it. I, as I say, was a son of a small businessman. We had very little trade union organization in the state of South Dakota, let alone in the little town of Iroquois. The only people that belonged to trade unions there were the people that worked for the railroad. And of course they were fairly well organized, the telegraphers, the people who worked on the section gangs, and the people that ran that portion of the railroad's operation in little town were members of union organizations, but they were not, you didn't see union meetings, you didn't see activity, because these towns were all far apart. We knew very little about trade unions in the town. What little propaganda we got was basically anti-union. It was not understood, first place. Most all of the people in that town read the little town paper, and it was Republican. I think probably if a person at that particular, when I was youngster growing up, a person had counted the population, it would have been 80% to 85%, I suppose, Republican, and the other, a few odds and ends, strangers in the town, kind of different. We're not particularly the business people. We're Democrats. And so the election was pretty solidly Republican. I didn't think a Democrat was really a decent human being when I was a kid. You know, I didn't know anything about him. Didn't know much about him. And certainly people in the trade union movement were not anybody that you admired, you heard about. John L. Lewis and the mine workers. And a little bit about the CIO in the early stages of my college career after I started going to college. But I didn't, you know, CIO wasn't born until 36. But after my year senior in high school back there, out here, I went back to Dakota. My folks moved back, and I went to 2 years to a little denominational college called, in a little town of Huron, about 10,000 population city. There were about, maybe 300 people in the college, students. After taking 2 years, I intended to try to go into chemistry, become a chemical engineer. Found out after 2 years of college and ended up having to sign notes and things in order to pay a tuition. Didn't have any money there. Everybody went broke during the Depression and the bank bust and stuff in 1929 crash. And the Depression in South Dakota, the economics of that state was such that if it hadn't have been for the New Deal during Roosevelt's administration, the input of government money into work programs like the WPA, CCs, if it hadn't been for that kind of thing, there would have been no cash money in the state, because in addition to having had the Depression, they had 7-year drought, and it was probably one of the slowest states in the nation to come out of the Depression. And so, as I say, I went to school for a couple of years, couldn't afford it any longer. I did go on to summer school and took some educational work and taught school in a rural school for the years of 36 and 37, 38 and 39. Taught in a little rural school where you had one teacher and all 8 grades in one room. I enjoyed it. I loved teaching work, but I was paid $50 a month. Not in cash, but like they're going to do the state of California, in warrants, which is a promise to pay if and when, you know, they collect enough taxes to have some money. The only way you could get cash money was that the bank would discount your warrant 10%. So if you had a $50 warrant, you could take it to the bank and they'd give you $45 for it in cash. The bank held the warrant, and in addition to collecting their $5 up front, why, they would get also the interest on it if and when taxes were paid. And so they would, that was the way the teachers survived then. The school that I was teaching in, the teacher who had taught there prior to me had been there for 5 years and had taken a reduction in pay each of those 5 years until it got down to $50. And then, because she was an experienced teacher, she had a chance to move to another township that would pay a little more. That moved. That's how I got the job. It was out about 10 miles north of the Indian Reservation in along the Missouri River in the Big Bend country. And so we had one Indian child going to our school. I had one student in each grade. It was very intriguing. Because in schools where you have one class and the teacher up front, you have a chance to have the children recite and an opportunity to orally review how they're progressing. In rural school, you don't have that time. You don't. If you have anybody in the primary grade, you spend 70% of your time trying to teach them in the beginnings, you know, read, write. So the older students, you rely almost entirely on giving them lessons to read, and then you develop your own test, series of tests, written programs, and usually had to do it with your own know-how and some of your own money because they didn't have, you know, you have to pay booklets and stuff. But anyway, that was the kind of a background I had. My
what
folks,
was the name of the
school?
Yeah.
It was just a little rural school in Eagle Township in Hyde County, South Dakota. In a township, you know, is the 36 sections of land of which the school owns two, and that the rentals and things from those two, plus a little tax from the other farmers, even where it's collected, is supposed to support the schools. And we had two schools in our township. Three the first year, they had to shut one of them down because you had to have so many students in order to maintain the school. Anyway, I had intended to go back again the next year, and I hadn't yet signed my contract because of we were still arguing a little bit about raises, because I was trying to get them to increase the amount of money. And I came out to California because my folks in the meantime had moved out here, and I just came out to visit them during the summer. And decided that I just didn't want to sit around, do nothing. And I never learned how to type. So I went to business school solely for the reason to learn to type. You know, you take just what courses you want. But while I was going, and I think the charge was $15 or something extra, I could take shorthand. And I took some review work and some bookkeeping that I'd taken back in high school. And I decided that I would spend a little time learning how to operate the old switchboard, which they had in the place. And, you know, just because I'd always been curious about how you punch those cords, mainly. While I was there, the typing teacher had a brother who worked in the oil fields at E.B. Hall and Company at that time. It's now Champlin out here in the harbor. They were the operators for the Union Pacific oil lease.
Yes.
The Union Pacific owned the land.
Yes.
But E.B. Hall ran the company at the time, I mean, did the oil operations at the time that I went to work there. And subsequently, they lost their contract to Champlin, who now is the operator for all of Union Pacific's properties, I think, in the United States. That has oil on it. But anyway, this brother of the typing instructor came down there one time and said that when if there was anybody that wanted a job out in the oil fields, working in the office, from 12 o'clock in the midnight to 8 in the morning to learn to run the switchboard and to do a little typing. And I inquired as to what it paid, and it paid $116 a month or something like that, which was so much more than I got as teaching. Well, can't hurt anything. I'll go out there and see if I can get the job, and I got it. And I worked there until I went in 1943, when I went to work for the union. I got a job in the oil field simply because it paid more money than in the oil industry. And I was working in the office. I was not out in the fields itself. Shortly after I was there, I became acquainted with labor management relations, working for a large company. It was not so much a personal drive for having the union until, as far as I was concerned, there was an attempt being made to organize the field, not the office, at the time that I would work there. And in the meantime, this was about a year later, I moved from 12 to 8 in the morning to 4 till 12 in the afternoon. Changed my shift. And the guy who replaced me also was, well, I'm getting a little out of line on the story. The guy that replaced me was about the same kind of a person I was in the sense of background and experience. But we both had a quality of life. We didn't particularly like some of the things that we saw that the employer did. For example, in the office, we had not had any wage raises. You didn't get a lot of wage raises in those days. You fought pretty hard to get 5 cents an hour, you know. Wages were such that you were earning below a dollar an hour, and you struggled hard to get just a little bit of money. And of course, if you weren't organized, you usually waited until the employer had found what other businesses and things were doing, and then he adjusted your wages sufficiently to keep you satisfied. That was about the way it usually went. Well, I don't know if you're acquainted with the way the economics was working in this country during the latter, in 1939 and 40, 41, 42, when we were producing weapons of war for a lot of people, but we weren't yet involved. And we were getting into the stages where they were beginning to freeze people in their job. You couldn't move from one job to another, especially if you were working in an industry which was related to defense, and they considered the oil industry as one of those industries. And they were trying to freeze wages and prices across the country so that there would not be a tremendous inflation during the period of the war. And they were trying to level off those wages. The unions were putting the pressure on to try to get some kind of a justifiable system, and of course the government was supporting. You know, it was pretty well understood in the country that we didn't want the same thing to happen during the period of the war that happened during the First World War. And so they passed the law was established on freezing the wages and prices, and a way to adjust the wages was what they called the little steel formula, because this was the formula that was established to permit those who had not received wage increases in a certain period of time to come up to the level of those that had them receive the wage increases. Now, this was not required by law, it was only permitted by law. And although we were still working the 40-hour week, in fact, in the oil industry, we were working the 36-hour week at that time, it was pretty sure we were going to the 40. And in some places, they had automatically done that already. But what labor contracts there were in effect were basically written on the 36-hour week. In other words, you didn't get overtime except past 40 in 1 week or 72 hours in the 2 weeks. And that was basically the work schedules in the petroleum industry. But we were working 40 hours, but not getting any overtime. In the office, in the fields, they would. But everybody was talking about we were going to, because so many people were being drafted or volunteering in the services, especially after 41, that it was going to require that people work more hours. And so the employer proposed to the people in the office, and there was only about 9 of us working in that office at that time, but he proposed to that 9 people that if he would give us the little steel formula wage raise, which amounted to 9 cents an hour in the office, he would let us have that wage raise, or we could take 40 hours, go from 40 hours a week to 48 hours a week, which would give you that additional 12 hours pay each week. Well, this fellow that I was telling about and myself voted to take the 9 cents, because it's very silly to tell them that you'll just work more hours to make more money, and we were sure anyway that before long everybody's going to be on the 48-hour week. But they polled the people in that office, and 7 of those people decided that they would take the 12 hours pay each week, because in dollars and cents, there's no question it meant more money, but it also took another day away from them, you know. And we argued with them, tried to convince them, but that was the way the thing came out. So we didn't get our 9 cents. Well, we began to organize the office because of that. And we finally got the office organized and part of the union. I actually joined the union in 1942, but my record shows that I became a member in March of, or February it was, of 1943. Because of some things I didn't know. I didn't know enough about unions to know the procedures. I signed a card and I paid them my initiation fee, and I kept waiting for them to tell me how to pay my dues. So I paid the initiation fee. And I never paid any more dues, because in the union at that time, you had to go down, have your name read at the membership meeting, and be accepted, and be there to take the obligation. Well, I didn't do that until about 6 months later, so I actually belonged to the union. I participated at the unit level out at the plant with our meetings. I went to those meetings, but I didn't go to the local meetings. I wasn't interested in the union in that way at that time. I did get on the committee. I worked on not the first contract, but after I saw the results of the first contract, I was intent on getting on the second one. I wanted, there were some changes that had to be made, I felt. One of the changes was in the question of seniority, but anyway. After I got active and finally became part of the union, well, then I served on as chairman of the committee and or secretary of it. Nearly all the rest of the time I worked at that company. But I didn't work there very long, because after I actually officially became, I worked for the company about a year and a half. Then I went to work for the local. But and the reason I got went to work for the local union, I was on the committee, and I was always pretty good at talking. And the international representative for the union was who was assisting us in our contract negotiations, was observing our committee and its actions, and stuff. And he asked, after we finished those negotiations, and I was arguing to get that 9 cents back that we lost, which we finally did, but it, he thought that I did a pretty good job, so he said, he asked me if I'd be interested in working for the local. I don't want you to translate that into the that I was a great shakes, some great champion type of a person. That wasn't the reason. Most of the real qualified guys with experience in the union movement had gone into the service. I couldn't get into the service. I volunteered, but I only had one eye and had rheumatoid arthritis since I was a kid, and I failed the physical examination, so I became one of those 4 Fs, which even though I felt it was they were discriminating against me because, one, I could see more out of one eye than a lot of people they had to draft could see out of two, which was not was my good fortune and their misfortune, but and the fact that although I had had the arthritis, I felt that I could do what a soldier had to do, but that'd be neither here nor there. I couldn't get in, and So I was one of those that was at home, and so many of the people who have been active in the union were of the age, especially the younger ones, of the age that went into the service. And so probably the people who would have had the job that I took for the local in 1944, about April it was, probably those people who would have had that job were in the service. Why? I went in way before my normal time to have taken a job leading the union. I worked for the local for about a year, and from April of 44 till about August the 28th, almost the end of August in 45.
And what local was this?
Local 128 here in Long Beach. I've been a member of Local 128 since all the time I was in the union.
And so this the hall office was in Long Beach then?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. When I worked for the local, it was.
But I mean, the office you worked in at the time you joined the union was also in
Long Beach. Yeah, mm-hmm. The local union's office at the time that I joined it was on 6th Street, just a little bit east of Alamitas, in a building that's still there, by the way. And the men themselves built that out of scrap lumber, that is, the members of the union built it out of lumber and stuff, secondhand, used lumber. And of course, there were many craftsmen in the industry, and so they all did their own work, you know, put it together. That was the way they did things in those days. They didn't go out and hire things done as much as their participation in their own program. But I worked for the local then for, as I say, a little over a year, in about 4 months. And then I was offered a job to go to work for the International Union as a representative, which I took. Was the representative of the International Union located in this Los Angeles, Long Beach area till December, the end of November in 1949, at which time they were making a change in the district directors, and I was given the job as a director of the Western, the District 1, the Western part of the United States, and was in that job for 10 years, almost to the day, not quite, about a month out of that. I left, I was asked to be the assistant to the president of the International Union in 1960. And I can remember because I voted for John Kennedy by absentee ballot because I had to leave by the 1st of November to be in Denver. So I voted here absentee ballot for John Kennedy. I worked as the assistant to the international president for 3 years, and no sooner had gotten back home in 1963, at the end of that third year, was when Kennedy was assassinated. So I can remember President Kennedy's term of office as president almost coincided with mine as assistant to the international president. I came back as an international representative and worked until there was a change in the president, and in 1971, in the convention in 1971, I was again asked to be the director here on the West Coast. And I was a director until I retired, which was in February 1st of 1979. So I suppose my time was about, let's see, I spent about a year and a half working for the local, 128. I was an international representative for 4 let's see, 4 and 8, 12 years, different times combined. I was director for 10, about 18 years. With 3 years out, well, no, I wasn't either. I was in 10 and 8, 18, that's about 15 years. 3 years as assistant to the president, I forgot that in there. So that was basically my history with the union. I ran through a lot of interesting experiences in all that time. I suppose some of the outstanding events, parts of that history, my experiences in the union were, first was in 1945. Shortly after I became an international representative, the war was over. All of the laws that impacted trade union movement.